The space industry is rapidly becoming privatized. So what role will NASA have in the future? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This week, WLRN-TV is airing a three-part documentary called Chasing the Moon by director Robert Stone.
The United States is ready to try and place its first Earth satellite into orbit. And there is a sudden tremendous...
This year is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Today, we're devoting an hour to the human desire to reach for the stars. We'll meet former astronaut Winston Scott, who grew up in Coconut Grove and is one of the few African Americans to go into space. Then there's Jean Wright. She was a seamstress for NASA, but what she sewed was a unique blanket that protected the shuttles during re-entry. And finally, a look at the future of space travel and when we'll be able to take vacations out of this world. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
50 years ago this week, astronauts took off from Cape Canaveral in the first manned mission to the moon. Since that mission, hundreds of more astronauts traveled beyond Earth's atmosphere with the help of thousands of employees, changing how billions of people understand the world we live in. Today, we're dedicating the entire program to those individuals behind NASA. You'll hear from an astronaut, a seamstress, and a reporter covering future trends. But first, let's talk about history. Robert Stone is the director of the PBS documentary Chasing the Moon. The three-part series tells the story of the U.S. space race in the 50s and 60s that led up to the 1969 launch. You can begin watching tomorrow night, by the way, at WLRN-TV at 8 p.m. and again on Wednesday and Thursday. We spoke with Stone last week and started the conversation with his experience watching that launch from the U.K.
I grew up in both England and the United States, but that summer of the 1969, I was in England. And I watched it. My mother woke me up at 4 o'clock in the morning when they walked on the moon, because it was in the middle of the night in Europe. And we had a little television set sitting in front of a big window. And I remember watching Armstrong and Aldrin bouncing around on the moon. And I look above, I noticed in the window, rising over the television was the moon. And it seemed like our little television had turned into some sort of weird giant telescope. It sort of blew my little 10-year-old mind.
As the 50th anniversary for the space launch was approaching, who were some of the voices you knew that you needed to include as part of the documentary project?
Well, I wanted to make a film that took a different approach than a lot of other documentaries that have been done about this. I felt the astronaut story had been told, and pretty well in several documentaries. But there was a larger context to this whole thing that really hadn't been told. So we have the astronaut story in our movie. I interviewed Buzz Aldrin, Frank Borman, Bill Anders, and Mike Collins is in the film as well. All audio. We don't have any talking heads in the film. It's all audio only interviews. But we have their story. But we also wanted to tell the story from some other perspectives. And I say three key ones spring to mind is Poppy Northcutt, who was the one and only woman who working in Apollo Mission Control. She was a return to Earth specialist at NASA. We have Ed Dwight, who was the first African-American astronaut trainee who was recruited by the Kennedy administration to be to integrate the early astronaut corps. He's got an incredible story. And another one I'd highlight would be Sergei Khrushchev, who was Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's son, who was at his father's side throughout the whole early history of the space race, and was himself a leading Soviet rocket engineer.
Yeah, you think about some of these, I guess, lesser-known people, or some of the behind-the-scenes people. Another one that you had, it was really cool, was the public affairs announcer, Ed Buckby. And this is a clip from the documentary from early on in his career.
My job was public relations. I graduated with a journalism degree and a commission in the United States Army. And guess where they sent me? Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama. And I went to work in the public affairs office, and that was the beginning of my career with Von Braun. Von Braun was there with his missile team, and they were preparing to launch a satellite.
Okay.
States is ready to try and place its first Earth satellite into orbit. And there is a sudden tremendous burst of flame. We can see the Jupiter 3 missile on its way.
I can understand why you'd want voices like his, I mean, watching the film. But how did you find him?
Well, Ed Buckby's a fascinating guy. He was at Von Braun's side as his personal assistant and spokesperson throughout the entire race to the moon, starting in 1957 all the way up through the moon landing. So he was a real eyewitness to history. Von Braun is one of the most fascinating characters of the 20th century, I think. He was the most pivotal figure in getting us onto the on the moon. He's the central character of the entire 6 hours of chasing the moon. He was a former colonel in Hitler's SS who came to the United States, teamed up with Walt Disney, sold the idea of space travel to the American public, launched America's first satellite, which is happening in the clip you just played, and then convinced President Kennedy the one way we could beat the Russians would be to move the goalpost, as it were, and commit America to doing something so audacious that both the Russians and the Americans would have to build new rockets. And so, he's got a wonderful story to tell.
I'm speaking with Robert Stone, director of the new PBS documentary series Chasing the Moon. WLRN-TV will broadcast all three parts on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, starting at 8 p.m. You can find more details on our website at WLRN.org. You know, Robert, some of the more compelling interviews are with, obviously, the former astronauts like Buzz Aldrin. But was it difficult to get them to that place where they might share stories that they haven't already told us?
Well, yes. But I think the advantage that I had was that I did audio-only interviews. I didn't go in there with lights and cameras and a big crew. Because these guys, obviously have told their stories countless times over the years. They kind of have a way of telling a story, which has been done again and again and again. But by going in there, just me sitting in their living room with a innocuous little tape recorder and a microphone, they totally, forgot that this was really kind of a formal interview. And we just had a conversation, and they were able to, they revealed things to me, emotional dimensions of this story, that they haven't revealed at other times.
How did Cape Canaveral and the Florida Space Coast become a character in the story? Did you do that on purpose?
It's a sort of a common question to ask people, like, if you could go back in time, when and where would you want to be? And I think, Cape Canaveral in the early 60s would be on my bucket list of places to go back in time to. I mean, what an exciting time to be in this lush tropical environment and sending men to the moon. And so we had found all of this incredibly beautiful footage that was shot, 16-millimeter color footage. You see the town just being completely transformed into a boom town, and the bars and the entertainment and partying on the beach and the rockets going up and the reporters drinking all night and staggering out to the launch site. And it's just, there's a wonderful milieu that took place. And we, some of the other characters we interviewed was Jack King, who was the head of the public relations at Cape Kennedy, who did the famous countdowns, ignition sequence start, all that stuff that's almost as iconic as Armstrong's first words on the moon, really. So we interviewed him. And some journalists, George Alexander of Newsweek and Mark Bloom of the New York Daily News, who were down there. So we tell that side of the story, too.
That's one of the things I've always been fascinated by, this idea, is looking at footage, reading stories of that generation, how people were so enthralled by the idea of going into space and, of course, the space race with the Soviets. But I wonder, today's generation, the younger generations, do they have much interest in space travel? Do we have that passion, that energy at all?
Well, I have two teenage sons. I do think there's a real interest in space travel. I think the core of it, though, is less about space travel per se, because they look back at that was a great thing. It pulled everybody together. People, I think human beings have a natural desire to want to be part of something bigger than themselves, to be involved in some grand enterprise. And, if you look back in history, we've generally done that through warfare. That's how we've channeled that natural human impulse, is in warfare. The space race was one of those unique moments where we channeled that into something positive. And everybody felt that they had a part of it. Even people who were opposed to the space program, who thought it was a waste of money, the optimism, the sense of possibility that it engendered, and the idea that, you know, there was a brighter tomorrow ahead, you know, that optimism was infectious and went, you know, across all spectrums of society and went around the world. So I think that's the thing that we've lost, is we've forgotten how to believe in the future. And I think space travel sort of represents that symbolically.
What do you think about how the space program has evolved? Because as you said, in the earlier days, it was driven by, you know, Kennedy and Khrushchev. But today it's going privatized and it's about Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. What do you think about how it's changing that way?
Well, human exploration certainly is being driven by private enterprise, and which is a good thing, because there's no real need for or support for the U.S. government to be funneling large percentages of the federal budget into human space exploration. I just don't think there's support for that. But if Bezos and Musk and others want to undertake this, I think that's amazing and inspiring and wonderful. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be right there in the front row applauding them. So I think that's great. I think we should also learn to love our robots. The robots are amazing. They are our emissaries. They're created by us, and they can go places where no human can go for a fraction of the cost. And it's incredibly inspiring to see what they've done, you know, landing on a comet a couple of years ago, going by Pluto, you know, seeing all the outer planets. We've got the Voyager spacecraft going off into interstellar space. Japanese are about to mine an asteroid, I think, in the next couple of days, really. It's incredibly exciting what we're doing. The space race the race to the moon is long over, but space exploration and human venturing into space is still exciting and is still happening. And I think it's incredibly inspiring.
But what about the idea of NASA? Should we protect NASA as an institution, or is just let it go and, you know, it's going to go in a different direction now?
I think maybe NASA might want to get out of the manned space business. The manned space business was really, in large part after the Apollo missions, was there to sustain support for everything else that NASA was doing. The public wasn't, you know, didn't get all excited about scientific exploration and all the earth science that was going on. So having humans in space, because people have this sort of vicarious connection to the people in space, I think that's why that aspect of the mission went on. But people are generally pretty bored, I think, with the space station. It's not a particularly inspiring thing. It's cost a lot of money. So if NASA continues on with the hard science and the robotic spacecraft while private enterprise pursues human exploration, I think that would be a good a division of labor, really.
That was Robert Stone, director of the PBS documentary Chasing the Moon. You could begin watching the 3-part series tomorrow beginning at 8 p.m. on WLRN-TV. Well, still to come, we're going to meet Winston Scott, a local astronaut who will share his stories about going into space. That's coming up next.
Full of money, all in debt. Sun coming out in the middle of June. Everyone's gone to the moon.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Captain Winston Scott served as a mission specialist with NASA on two operations. In 1996 and 1997, Scott was essential in the development of the International Space Station, and he even rescued a multi-million-dollar satellite. He grew up in Coconut Grove. He went to George Washington Carver High School before Dade County schools were integrated, and went to Coral Gables Senior High School after that. He's a retired naval captain And as we mark the 50th anniversary of the U.S. landing on the moon, Scott joins us to talk about his time with NASA, his time as an astronaut. Mr. Scott, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, it's interesting. I wondered for you, what was that moment in your life as a kid when you became interested in science, but especially in space?
I don't remember when that occurred. I was interested in science and space as far back as I can remember. It started way, way, way back in elementary school. But even though I was interested and followed it, it didn't appear to be a reality to me. It was something that you read about in magazines and books and saw on TV. It was not a reality until many, many years later. But as far back as I can remember, I was interested in science, technology, flying, and so on.
Now, tell me a little bit about growing up in Coconut Grove, and as you were there and you saw how, again, how the district became integrated, and that changed your life and what you had access to.
Well, absolutely. As you said, the schools were segregated up through ninth grade for me, even though I grew up in modern times. You know, I'm not an ancient old person, you know, but the schools were segregated. And because they were segregated, we in my all black neighborhood weren't exposed to the things that we would have been, that we were later exposed to when integration occurred. Now, we did have some very, very insightful teachers, and one of my teachers particularly would bring in articles about the new space program at that point. And the first book I checked out from the public library was a book called Project Mercury. But by and large, we in the minority community were not exposed to careers like engineering and physicists and astrophysics and things like that. We didn't know what those things were. I didn't know what an engineer did. I thought an engineer drove a train, you know. So I, even though I was interested in science and technology, I had no real exposure to it and was not inspired to study until later on in my life. But having said that, I had a very, very good upbringing in the all-black section of Coconut Grove. We had a caring community, good teachers. The teachers were very, very well qualified, although our equipment was secondhand. And the old adage about a community raising a child was true, because even though I grew up in the city, everybody pretty much knew each other, and all adults looked out for all the children, and everybody had a hand in directing you and guiding you. So overall, it was a very, very good upbringing in segregated Coconut Grove.
And you talked about how the science and all of that came later in your life. You were a musician, and that's what got you into Florida State, right?
Exactly. When I went over to Coral Gables High School, you know, by that time I was heading into 10th grade. And at that time, you begin formulating what you're going to do in life. I was a very, very good musician. I was blessed with a talent for music, and I enjoyed it. And I was thought 10 through 12, I would go off and become a professional musician. Got into Florida State University because of my musicianship. But the university, of course, broadened my horizons, which is what universities are supposed to do. And I discovered engineering and began taking math, science, and engineering courses as an overload. I would routinely take 20 and 21 hours a quarter. We wanted a quarter system. But I would take 21 hours a quarter because I was taking calculus in addition to music theory.
So it was in college when you started to get into that aspect of the science of STEM, really.
That's right.
When did the Navy come into play?
Well, I was just about to, again, I got into science and engineering late, halfway through my college curriculum. And I had to graduate in 4 years. So I finished my music degree because I was close to finishing that. And I was looking for a way to continue to stay in school and study engineering. And just in the back of my mind, because I had no formal guidance, it occurred to me that I've heard the military will send people to school. So I began inquiring about the military. Now, this is the time when the Vietnam War was still going on, and there were actual protests against the war. My friends were dodging the military. But the military was tugging at me, so to speak. It was enticing me and calling to me. And long story short, I wound up applying to the Air Force and to the Navy for flight training because I thought the military might send me back to college later. Flight training was in my mind. The Navy responded first, accepted me, as a brand new cadet in the flight training, and the rest, as they say, is history.
And then that's it. When you were in the Navy, that's when all of a sudden the idea of being an astronaut popped into your life.
That's right. At least that's when it came to fruition. I suspect that somewhere way in the back of my mind, the little kid back in third grade that read Project Mercury probably had the seed planted then, and it was lying dormant and began to blossom later on in college.
What was it like for you when you go into the space program? I wondered about some of the barriers and challenges you faced because, I mean, up to that point, you still only had men, and it was white men who were in the space program.
Well, the challenges started at my back at Florida State University and
Yeah.
continued through the Navy. I mean, I was the only African American person to receive my Navy wings, and in every unit that I was in, I was the only black pilot. So the challenges continued. Then I can say that we continue to improve in this country, and every institution continues to improve. And as I progressed through my Navy career, for every person that would treat me unfairly, there were two or three persons who were fair. So th things were changing, people were changing, they were becoming more accepting to minorities and to women in these professions. And of course, that is as it should be. So not
Yeah,
sure what else I can say about
no,
that,
no.
but
Thank you for sharing that with us. You're one of a few people. When you think about like the billions of people that have lived on this planet, there are only a few who've ever gotten out of the stratosphere, gotten out into space. How do you describe to people what it's like to be in space?
there are no words to adequately describe it. I try to say things like awesome and try to tell them how the planet looks and how small and how fragile and how paper thin the atmosphere and you can see past and how bright and beautiful and colorful it is and how peaceful it looks. No turmoil, like you see when you turn on the 6 o'clock news down here. But all of those words just fall short of describing what it's actually like. It's just absolutely incredible. And being an astronaut, being selected and flying in space is a true life-changing event, not just for those who of us who do it, but for all of your family, your friends, your acquaintances, people who know you only from afar. You really impact and touch their lives. So it is an incredible experience and a privilege and an honor to have been selected.
I'm talking with former astronaut Captain Winston Scott. He grew up in Coconut Grove and went on to serve two missions in space. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And again, you could share your stories about the lunar landing and watching the PBS documentary Chasing the Moon. It starts tomorrow, airs tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday at beginning at 8 o'clock. You had, as I mentioned, you had a couple of missions, and a big part of it was, it was essential for the International Space Station. What, tell us a little bit about the focus of your trips.
Yes, both trips were actually built as microgravity missions. That means they were pure science. We were growing crystals in space, growing plants in space, and laboratory experiments and so on. But really, the bulk of the missions were to test out tools, equipment, and techniques that astronauts later used to build the space station. In fact, one of the things that I was privileged to do was test improvements to the spacesuit itself. When NASA was planning to build the space station, it was going to be in a location in space that was colder than we had traditionally gone. So they made improvements to the extravehicular mobility unit, EMU, or the spacesuit. They made improvements to it to handle these super cold temperatures. And they put it on my flight, and I was assigned to go outside and test those improvements. And we had a successful test, of course, and that suit is being used today. So there are many, many bits of the equipment and tools and so on that we tested, of course, that allowed the space station to be erected.
I want to get to this one though. You had to rescue a multi-million-dollar satellite. This is like a movie script. Tell me what happened.
Oh man, like I said, that was an incredible event. We took a satellite into space with us. It was a Spartan solar observation satellite. Our job was to place it into orbit, then back away from it for 2 days. We'd go off and do something else for 48 hours. It would make measurements of the sun's corona. Then we will fly back up to it, grapple it, put it back into the payload bay, and bring it home so that scientists could download its data post-flight and learn more about the sun. Well, satellite malfunctioned, and it developed a very slow spin in space. You've got a satellite about the size of a small automobile very slowly turning in space. Well, because the satellite was turning, we couldn't grapple it with the space shuttle's robot arm. So, long story short again, it was decided that in order to retrieve it, my buddy and I would go outside on a spacewalk and attempt to catch that satellite by hand. And we did. We again, there were days and days of planning and rehearsals and so on, verbal rehearsals. And on the day of the spacewalk, we went outside in 3.5 hours is what it took. But we managed to grab that satellite by hand, lock it into the payload bay so that it could be brought home,
now,
and repaired and set up on a future mission.
Now, come on, Winston. The other thing, too, is that that gentleman that you went out there with, I believe, was Japanese, and he didn't speak any English.
Well, no. His English was excellent. Yes,
okay.
A Japanese astronaut, Takao Doi. Takao was on his first flight,
okay,
on his first spacewalk, and we're asking him to go outside and help catch a satellite. And his English was excellent, but it's not like you and I out there. See, if you and I were out there together, you know, I could say some of anything, and you would understand me. So with Takao, I had to rehearse the terminology I was going to use and then not deviate from that so as to not introduce confusion. But Takao was the first Japanese astronaut to walk in space, as a matter of fact. So he made history there in Japan and just did an excellent job. But yeah, he and I grabbed that thing and we wrestled it into the payload bay and we brought it home.
Sounds like a movie. It sounds like, yeah, a movie. I'm ready to watch
it. It's one of those moments that come to us sometime in life where we can grab hold of the that situation and wrestle it, go for it, or we can shy away from it. And we decided to go for it, and we were successful.
Something that jumps out at me is, so I know that there's always this talk about tourism in space, and some of these private companies are trying to build that ability for us, just average folks, to be able to go out into space. But I think about all the training that you have to do to be an astronaut, and I'm just thinking, is it really going to be possible for everyday folks like me to be able to travel into space?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, an analogy would be the airplane. You know, early on, when airplanes were first invented, the only people who flew them were pilots, you know, the Wright brothers first. And then the great advances were done by military pilots. But those advances came out, filtered out into commercial aviation. So now anybody can get on an airplane and fly as a passenger. Well, the same thing is going to be true for spaceflight. As a tourist, anybody can get on there and fly. You don't have to be a crew member. You're not going to pilot the thing. Or you're not going to work on it. You're not going to rendezvous and dock with it. You're not going to conduct experiments. You meaning the general public. So, yeah, absolutely. Space tourism is coming, and anyone of reasonable health will be able to climb in, buy a ticket, climb in, and go. And that's fantastic. You know, we want to see that happen.
What do you think is the future of NASA? I mean, we talk about privatization of the space industry. What's going to happen to NASA?
I think we need a strong NASA, because privatization is doing just what it should do. It's making space affordable. It's making access to space efficient and affordable. But the cutting edge research really needs to be done by the government. If you look at the parallel to aviation again, all the great advances in aviation have been done by the government. The research has been funded by the government. They were driven by the war, you know, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and so on. But that was government funded. But the advances that came about from government research has filtered out into commercial aviation. The commercial companies now, Delta, United, and so on, they come along and they make it affordable. Southwest Airlines, you know, they have made flying so affordable that anybody can fly on an airplane. When I was growing up, you know, only rich people could fly. So space is going to be the same way. The cutting edge research really needs to be done by a government in partnership with other governments. Commercial companies are only going to invest so much money into research. They want a return on investment, and rightly so. So what they do is they bring the business sense to it, and they make it affordable. They make it cost effective so that more and more people can have access. But we definitely need a strong government. And for space, our government agency is NASA. So I'd like to see us really begin to support and fund NASA the way we used to, and because we need that. Without a strong NASA, we, the United States, will soon fall behind other countries in terms of space exploration.
Let me finish with this briefly. Can you play a trumpet in space?
Well, absolutely. If you're inside of the spaceship, of course. Now, outside, of course, you could play a trumpet because you could live without the trumpet would have to somehow be inside of your suit or your cap. So, but let me say this: there have been a number of astronauts who've taken instruments into space with them. Several astronauts, and they've played very successfully and had a lot of fun playing inside of the space station or a space shuttle, of course.
Sounds like the name of a group, the Astronauts. Captain Winston Scott, again, he served two missions in space. Captain Scott, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, we're going to meet a woman who had one of the most important missions with NASA. Her work protected the space shuttles. We'll explain coming up next.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again so much for joining us. We're going to switch things up a little bit because we were going to talk to this very unique woman who worked for NASA as a seamstress, but we're trying to make that connection. So for now, I want to turn things over and we're going to talk about the future of the space program because we heard from an astronaut. We heard from the director of this documentary. What is the future of NASA? Is space now in the hands of the private industry? Do we as a nation have the same interest or desire to go into space? Well, joining me now is Brendan Byrne. He covers space news for WMFE in Orlando. He's also the host of Are We There Yet? WMFE's Space Exploration Podcast. Brendan, great talking to you.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, let me start with this. The Trump administration wants to go back to the moon, and he wants to do it in 5 years. Why?
Well, that's a very good question, and we got an answer to that earlier this year. So the Trump administration, via Vice President Mike Pence, made this speech saying that we're going to put humans back on the moon in the next 5 years. And they laid out quite a few reasons, but the main reason was to establish the U.S. as a dominant presence in space once again. And they cited, competition from other countries like China and Russia, and trying to paint this as another space race, and the next humans to step foot on the moon, in the words of Mike Pence, will be American astronauts.
You spoke recently with, I guess, a space advocate on your podcast, someone who tries to convince people of the importance of space travel. And tell us about what he said, why we should still care.
Well, yeah, I think you're referring to Frank White, who is an author, and he's interviewed dozens of, if not hundreds of astronauts. And he kind of coined this term called the overview effect. And this is something that he found that astronauts experience. And it's kind of like almost a religious epiphany when you see the Earth from the perspective that only a few hundred people have as an astronaut, and you see it as this, blue-green marble on this black backdrop, and you really get a sense of place. And you look down at Earth, and there's no boundaries, there's no borders. It's all just one thing. And it's kind of this almost spiritual moment that astronauts have, and they come back with. And a lot of astronauts that I've talked to have described this as well. I think back to Nicole Stott. She was a shuttle and ISS astronaut. And she's a painter now, and she, paints these beautiful pictures of what she saw in hopes to get people to kind of have that same sense of place and kind of humanity that she saw from space. And so Frank White wrote a new book basically talking about the overview effect and how we need to lay out some groundwork, because as you were talking with your last guest, more and more people are going to get to go to space and get to experience that same overview effect, right? They're going to be able to see that as well. So he advocates that we should be pushing to get everyone up there, so that everyone can have this perspective on their home planet, like no other.
I want to do it for the frequent flyer miles. real quickly, we talked to Robert Stone, again, the director of the Chasing the Moon, and he said NASA should get out of the manned missions. You know, with your coverage, what can you tell us about how NASA views its future?
Well, NASA views its future as doing the things that the commercial industry can't or won't do. So those are kind of like the science missions. You know, there's really no commercial value in sending a space probe to Venus or Pluto, right? So NASA has to be the one who does that. NASA's perspective on human spaceflight, they are the ones that, in their eyes, they think that they should be the ones, you know, going to the places like the moon and Mars and laying the groundwork for commercial companies to follow. To do that, they've been relying a lot more on commercial partners to do the kind of tedious, monotonous things, you know, like sending supplies up to the International Space Station or soon humans. They're putting a lot of the reliance on the private industry for that, so that NASA can do the really big things.
So what's the Space Force that the Trump administration has touted? Is that real?
The Space Force is would be a separate branch of the military that the president has asked for. It reached some resistance from Congress. A separate branch of the military would have to be created by the Congress. So instead, President Trump signed an order to create Space Command, which is something a little bit different. It's a strategic command post that would basically streamline space operations from other branches of the military. So right now, the Air Force, the Navy, you know, they all have a significant hand in space operations that would move towards this combatant command group.
I'm just thinking of Buck Rogers. That's for me, that's what I'm thinking about. Do you think that people still care about space travel the same way, and the space industry, and just, you know, sending people into space the same way they did when we launched astronauts to the moon 50 years ago?
No, and that's supported by some recent polling that we've had, that, you know, folks don't know what's going on or don't care as much as they have, and aren't in support for increasing the budgets. It has been almost 9 years since we've launched a human from U.S. soil. That may soon change as early as the end of this year, when either SpaceX or Boeing launches one through a commercial partnership to the International Space Station. But you're starting to see more excitement here on the Space Coast. SpaceX launches always garner a huge public audience, especially with the Falcon Heavy and the fact that they land their nearly 200-foot-tall booster,
yeah,
sometimes back on the coast. So it's getting there. It is nowhere near the levels that it was in the days of Apollo 11. But even in the days of Apollo, you know, public support and public interest waned after the moon landing.
Yeah, yeah. Last question real quickly. If you can go to the moon or Mars, where would you go?
Ooh, well, first I take you because we both want to go, right?
Okay, but no, where would you go?
On the moon?
The moon or Mars.
Oh, the moon or Mars. I'm sorry. That's a very good question. Probably the moon, because
yes,
I get homesick.
Yeah, that, and I saw that movie with Matt Damon, and I'd be scared of getting stuck out there. So
absolutely. Well, I hope you come with me, regardless.
All right, let's do it. We got it. We're doing the moon.
Sounds good.
Brendan Byrne covers space for WMFE. He's the host of Are We There Yet? WMFE Space Exploration Podcast. Brendan, always a pleasure.
Oh, I love being on the show. Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet the woman who had that really cool job with NASA as a seamstress, but she'll explain what she did. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. What if I told you that the exterior of the space shuttle is actually this thick giant blanket. And there was a group of women, super seamstresses, that worked to protect the spacecraft from that intense heat during reentry. Jean Wright moved to Florida in 2005. She became part of what was later termed the So Sisters. On today's show, again, marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, she joins us now. Jean Wright, such a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me. It's such an exciting time this week with the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Oh, it definitely is. You know, you held this unique position with NASA, but tell us, I mean, it was such a vital role because the shuttle could not reenter without it. What was your position?
Well, it's a long one. It was called Aerospace Composite Tech Soft Goods. Soft Goods is NASA speak for anything to do with fabric that flew on the space shuttle.
And so your job basically is, I mean, you were a seamstress, but you were putting this very important fabric on the shuttle to protect it.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. But we not only did the blankets, we did thrusters and thermal barriers around the wheel well doors and the engine blankets. There's a lot of things we did. But what you're primarily speaking about, they're called flexible insulation blankets, and they're done in various thicknesses. A lot of people think the thicknesses determine the heat load, but it's what we're gluing the blankets to. But they were about a half an inch thick to 2 inches thick. They took the place of over 7,000 white tile and saved us 7,000 pounds, surprisingly. And at $10,000 a pound to send something into space, you try and save as much weight as you can. But the blankets were rated for anywhere between 650 to 1,300 degrees, which is exactly what the blankets did and the tiles did too. They both did the same temperature ranges.
Can you tell me how you make these? I'd imagine you're not using a typical sewing machine, but how did you do this?
Well, you know, you technically could have. It's a quartz fabric, and the thread is quartz. The batting is quartz. The fabric that actually glues to the shuttle skin itself was just plain old fiberglass. But you're right. It was a unique sewing machine called a multi-needle. So heavy, we had to put it on our first floor of our building, and it's about 10 feet tall. And it almost looks like a loom, a weaving loom. And it had 30 needles, about 4 gallons of WD-40 to help lubricate the fabric and the needles. And it took about 3.5 minutes for it to quilt one way. We would turn the plate the other way, and then it would quilt the other way. And it would quilt a finished piece called a PU, or production unit, that was a 30 by 30 inch piece of quilted fabric that from there, looking at the blueprint, we would draw our own patterns and draw it on the blanket itself and cut it out, hand knot where all the threads intersected, flip the fabric to the back, and every one of them, all 1,300 of them, are hand sewn on the back to finish them off before we glue them on the shuttle.
Wow, that is so cool listening to that. Thank you for sharing that. Hey, tell me about the So Sisters. How many people were in the group?
18 of us, just a small group.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? I mean, I'd imagine you guys you really got really close.
Well, we did. It was a team effort out there. I think I annoyed my coworkers since I was the last one that got hired to do the job. Because what I would do is I kept a logbook and I would write down what shuttle or orbiter my part I was making was going to and what date I made it. And things like that. So every time I pulled my book out, they'd go, oh, there's Jean in her book again. But it came in handy as the program was winding down because one of the reporters asked us, well, what was the last flag that was sewn into a payload bay? And nobody knew. So I whipped out my book and I said, Debbie Mitchell and Jackie Isom made it. And it was for Discovery. And I had the date down. So I wrote down everything like that. They thought it was odd, but I didn't, and I still have the book.
Do you still keep in touch with all of your friends from the So Sisters?
I do. Some of them have moved on. I still have a few that are still there at the thermal protection facility where we worked at. We see each other every now and then. Primarily, we contact each other on Facebook, and we do have Christmas parties at our old building, and we'll still see each other every now and then.
I'm talking with Jean Wright. She's a former seamstress with NASA's Space Shuttle Program. She has a much more technical title than that, by the way. She worked at the Kennedy Space Center for about 6 years and designed the fabric that covers the exterior of spacecrafts and protects them during reentry. And you can find some photos of her on our social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, Jean, we have one of those photos, and it's of you pointing at some of the stitches on the fabric. And that's the work. Tell us a little bit about that moment.
But that one was an exciting moment because Discovery, that's from Discovery. It was getting ready to go to the Smithsonian, and I was the last one to sew her thermal barriers. Those are 4 feet long, spring tubes inside of them, and they allow, we put hand sew them. The part takes us 4 days. We have 12, three on each wall of the nose landing gear, and then we hand stitch them into place. And so I was the last one to sew her thermal barriers in before she flew up to Washington, D.C. So before she left, they let me go back up in the front wheel well, and I could point out my stitches so I could show my granddaughters. And then when I was asked to speak at Smithsonian 3 years ago, they let me climb up there or look underneath there. And by that time, the bright pink thread had turned white, which is common. So it was just neat to see that those were my stitches that will always be at the Smithsonian.
Jean, tell me how you got this job.
Oh, you know, that's kind of funny. I did a lot of praying about it because it was something I wanted to do from the time I was probably 10 years old and really had no idea that everyone thinks math and science and you don't think seamstress or sewing. But I had a feeling we knew we had with the spacesuits. Really what happened was is I applied after I saw a friend of mine, Pilar Ryan, who was hand sewing a blanket. And they did a return to flight series in Florida Today, our local newspaper. And without her even knowing me, I shot her an email and asking her what the qualifications were. And she didn't have to answer, but she did. So from then, I wrote myself a resume, shot it off, and didn't hear anything for 6 months. And January of 2005, I thought, I better tweak it. And I had a two-hour-long interview because I got a call to come back. And Kennedy Space Center came on the caller ID, and I thought someone was playing a cruel joke to me. I really did. I really did. But it was to call me for an interview, and I had a two-hour-long interview in front of three people. They were surprised at my knowledge of the program, and the passion was there. And you've got to remember, I only got hired because somebody had left, and they hadn't hired anybody in 9 years, and we were trying to catch up on our contracts because we were delayed for 3 years after we lost Columbia. And we still had contracts of sending segments up to the space station for Japan, the ESA, European Space Agency. So everybody told us the schedule will really pick up. So I got hired. But after my interview, I'm jumping all around, sorry. After my interview, my boss asked me if I wanted to go out to the thermal protection facility. And I thought that was a courtesy that was given to everybody who interviewed that day. But 4 days later, I got a call. Kennedy Space Center on the caller ID again. And my daughter was there. And I said, oh, Jenny, this is the most important phone call your mom will ever get in her whole life. And it was them saying that they had hired me. And my boss got on the line and said, frustrated, you had no idea when we invited you to go to the thermal facility that we had hired you. And I said, no. And he said, you had such heart and such passion. He said, we were still feeling the loss of Columbia. And he said, there was just a spark about you, an enthusiasm and a passion. And he said, I'll interview the rest of these ladies, but I've already made up my mind. And he said that as soon as I left, he goes, I want her. And I was the last one ever to get hired.
Oh, what a great story. That's yeah. So fantastic. Real briefly before we finish up is just I wanted to get a sense from you of, you know, because you talk to young people and, you know, you're a grandmother. Do young people have that same passion and energy for space and science that we had growing up?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. It depends. I would say it's probably split. I still have a few people who still don't even believe we even went to the moon. Oh, that's frustrating.
That's another
but
show.
I would say, oh, you're not kidding. But I have to say, it's about split, but I would say there's still some. I mean, we still have parents who bring their kids up in a fake astronaut costume, which is cute to see. But the ones who are very excited about space, they're very passionate. And I can always tell by the questions that they ask me which ones are the ones that are really going to be steered in that direction. And that makes me happy, especially when I talk about yes, math and science is important, but I encourage even younger kids that we need people with creativity who think outside the box, and NASA needs people, even people like me who sew. So I tell them how important it is to learn how to sew, even if it's just to learn how to put a button on.
Absolutely. Jean Wright, again, formerly of NASA. Learn more about her story at WLRN.org. Jean, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
It was such a fun story. Well, that's our program for this Monday, July 15th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Shoot for the stars. I'll talk to you tomorrow.